This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Truth, an uncomfortable book about relationships by Neil Strauss.
Chapter 21. Tommy and Chelsea arrive outside the apartment in a mostly windowless white serial killer van. After parking, he hauls out the briefcases and bags I saw in his room in Vegas. He opens one briefcase to display a collection of dildos that range from medium pink to ginormous black. There's something sinister about two men standing in the street at night and staring into a box of phalluses. "Are those the toys you sell?" I ask to break the awkward silence. "Rent," he corrects me. "You rent sex toys?" It's quite possibly the worst business idea I've ever heard. You'd have to be a pretty fearless swinger to want a used sex toy that's had someone's possibly diseased juices all over it. We clean and disinfect them after each use, of course. Of course. As Tommy explains his business, I start to understand that he's not in it for the money. The real payoff is that he's constantly hired to attend sex parties, where he sets up shop like a medicine show, encouraging women to test the toys until the room turns into a XXX-rated Tupperware party. His used sex toys, as disgusting as they sound, are the equivalent of Kamala's poojas, the spark to the gas of anticipation. After hauling his gear into the living room, Tommy tells me that everything's ready. And that's when I realize, I don't know this guy at all. I don't even know how well Nicole and James know him. In Vegas, Chelsea did say they were new to the scene. He opens a bag filled with extraordinarily unsexy gadgets that look like they were stolen from a 1950s research lab. Their sole purpose, he explains, is to give varying degrees of electric shocks to masochists looking for a new type of pain. He also has a duffel bag filled with varying lengths of thick black nylon rope. The whole array is like something out of a horror film. For all I know, I may have just invited serial killers into the house, swinging psychopaths. The crown jewel of his collection is the Sibian. Priced at more than $1,300, it's the Cadillac of sex toys. He spreads a blanket on the floor as if we're about to have a picnic or roll up my dead body in it. He carefully places his Sibian on it, then tops the saddle with a small rubber-ridged pad that has what looks like a large pencil eraser sticking out of it. From another briefcase, he removes several meticulously folded squares of plastic wrap, opens one, and places it on top of the pad. I have no idea if plastic wrap is an effective barrier against pathogens, but fortunately, I won't be sitting on it. Chelsea hikes her skirt and straddles the Sibian. "Look at that ass," Tommy urges me. Thanks to my dinner conversation with James, I understand that this is my cue to give him the male approval he needs. A work of art, I tell him. "You control it," he says and gestures to a small square box with a dial that goes from 0 to 100. It sits on the floor, attached to the Sibian by a black cord. I slowly bring the vibration level up to 25, and as the pad moves in faster and smaller motions than anything the male finger is capable of, Chelsea starts moaning. The sound is an intoxicant. Instantly, blood rushes from my head, where all common sense and caution reside, to my loins, where nothing but instinct and the moment live. As I slowly bring the dial to 30, her body flushes, and she tilts her head skyward, as if seeing the face of God. Whatever she's feeling, I'm jealous of it. I don't think I'm biologically capable of experiencing that kind of pleasure, unless there's a Sibian equivalent for men, perhaps some sort of jelly-filled, soft-walled vacuum cleaner that keeps saying you're the biggest and best it's ever been with. Tommy kneels behind Chelsea and massages her back and shoulders, occasionally adding a resounding slap on her ass. "Why don't we switch places?" he turns to me and suggests after a few minutes. This appears to be a routine they're running. They know exactly where the night's going, and I hope it isn't anywhere that involves tying me up and using the dildo collection. I'm sure these two could get just about anyone alone and vulnerable with their whole want to see my girlfriend use an expensive sex toy routine. I give Tommy the controls and watch as he brings it up to 50. It's violently fast, and Chelsea is thrown into an altered state of pleasure. "You can touch her if you want," he offers. I cautiously rub her back and arm through her blouse. She grabs my hands and smashes them onto her breasts as the Sibian takes her higher. Tommy lowers the speed so that Chelsea can remove her shirt and bra, then dials it up until it's at 100, and Chelsea's fake breasts are firing like pistons. I can't tell anymore whether she's moaning from pleasure or pain, but when Tommy starts cycling it down again, the word "more" escapes from Chelsea's gorgeously open mouth. The skin on her face and chest bursts with every shade of pink. Suddenly, her hand lunges like a cobra and grabs my crotch through my jeans. I glance at Tommy for permission, so that he knows whatever is going on, it's being done with respect for him. "She's too much for me," he responds, nodding like we're bros in this adventure together. "She once came 14 times in one night. That's why I appreciate what you're doing." Despite all the Vegas decadence, I've never had sex with another man's girlfriend in front of him. This is about to be my first actual swing, or half swing. After a few more minutes, Chelsea dismounts and lies on the bed. Tommy grabs a length of rope from one of his bags. I back away just to be safe and watch as he ties Chelsea's hands together over her head. "Do you have any latex gloves?" Tommy asks afterward. When I tell him I didn't happen to bring any, he gives me a condom and tells me to put it on my pointer finger so I can touch her. This is free love in the 21st century. It's hygienic, electronic, and sanitary. After an old-fashioned manual orgasm, Chelsea asks softly, almost meekly, "Which one of you wants to enter me?" "You didn't get to go last time, so it's your turn," Tommy says magnanimously, like she's a ride at an amusement park. "That's okay. I shouldn't be doing this. It feels compulsive, impulsive, even slightly repulsive. All the pulsives." I massage Chelsea's chest for a few minutes, stalling for time. As she grinds her hips and moans, I snap back into the moment. Fuck it. Why am I holding back again? He wants me to have sex with her. It would be a personal insult to both of them if I didn't. That's why they're here. Besides, I'm trying to have free relationships that don't hold anyone back from these types of adventures. This is exactly what I told everyone from Joan to Ingrid that I believed in. Sex as an end in itself. So I ask him for another condom. "Is it okay if I film it?" Tommy asks. "No," I scream instinctively. "That's the last thing I need, leaking all over the internet." "Why?" he asks, as if my answer makes no logical sense whatsoever. "Let's just savor the memories," I tell him. As I try to get myself back in the mood, I start to worry that he has a camera hidden somewhere. Technology gets smaller and easier to conceal every day. "You haven't been filming, have you?" I double check. "No, sir," he says, "but I have been recording audio." I thought I was starting to understand the swing scene, but this makes absolutely no sense. What the fuck is he going to do with the audio recording? Play it in the car on long road trips? "Can you turn it off?" I ask. "Are you sure? Sometimes I like to listen back to the moans." This guy is a freak. I absolutely should not fuck his Barbie doll girlfriend, who's spread-eagled naked in front of me. So I pull my pants down, just low enough to get my dick out without showing too much ass and skin, in case there's a hidden camera somewhere, and enter her. As I thrust inside, Tommy props a pillow against the wall and lounges there, watching. "Do you like the way it feels?" he asks her. "Do you like the way he's fucking you?" "Mm-hmm," she articulates. I assume he's trying to stay involved and in control in some way. I try to tune out his voice, to shut his form out of my peripheral vision, to move faster and lose myself in Chelsea. "Wow, look at you go," he exclaims. "It's like a jackhammer." Now he's commenting on the whole thing like a fucking sports announcer. I ignore him and start grinding my pubic bone against her clit to turn her on again. "That's interesting," Tommy says. "I haven't seen that one before. Is that your style? This is a terrible time for a discussion about technique. I don't know, I tell him. Just improvising as I go. It's not easy fucking someone while trying to carry on a conversation with her fiancé. It's like trying to race a motorcycle while texting. Tommy's silent for 30 blessed seconds or so. Then he unties Chelsea and announces, "Condom check." I'm worried he wants to feel it to make sure it's still on, so I reach down, confirm that it's completely snug, and tell him everything is in order. "Show him that thing you do with your hips," he instructs Chelsea, who lifts said hips and starts moving rapidly up and down along my shaft. When I flip her over, Mr. ESPN goes, "I like that. That's a good one." He doesn't appear to be getting turned on by watching. He seems more like a detached observer studying gorilla mating habits. And every time I change positions, he makes a new comment as if he's on the verge of some evolutionary discovery. Hopefully, this isn't narration for an audio recording. It's time to pull the curtain on the show. I force myself to come, careful not to make a sound in case Tommy's recording. Relieved that it's over, I pull out, remove the condom, drop it onto the floor, and lie next to Chelsea. As I stroke her hair and try to enjoy the afterglow, Tommy, of course, pipes up and ruins the moment. I can't make the words out exactly, but they sound like, "Let's see the juice." "What do you mean?" I ask. "I need to see the condom so I can make sure it caught everything." I want to ask him how he's going to know whether or not it caught everything. Maybe he has a semen measuring scale in his duffel bag that he uses to weigh the load. I fish around the floor for the rubber and hold it up so he can see. I really don't want him touching my used condom. "That's good," he approves. I put it back on the ground and silently pray he doesn't collect it before he leaves and put it in a formaldehyde jar in one of his briefcases. Tommy returns to Chelsea's side, kisses her softly, and tells her, "I adore you, honey." "You were incredible," I compliment her for him. As they lie there, I make swinger pillow talk and ask them how long they've been doing this. They've been dating for 5 years, they tell me. But a year and a half ago, they put an ad on Craigslist and selected a guy, then went to his house and she gave him a hand job. She gave the next guy a blowjob. Finally, they found a swinger couple on the lifestyle lounge, but Chelsea became sick with jealousy while watching Tommy ravish another woman. It took a dozen swings until Chelsea became comfortable enough to let Tommy interact with other women again. Their story reminds me of Tall's and Lawrence's. If you want to open your relationship, then proper etiquette is required. Ladies first. I bid them goodnight and invite them to crash on the pull-out couch if they want. As I lie in bed, I reflect on my experiences with Chelsea, Nicole, and their friends. Swinging is the best alternative I've seen so far, and I like the way some of the couples form long-term intimate relationships with other couples, becoming both best friends and lovers. But I'm not like Tommy or James or Corey Feldman. I don't get off on seeing other guys sweat on my girlfriend. I'm sure there are just as many men who are in the lifestyle simply for their own sexual gratification and variety, and willing to tolerate letting their wife screw another man in exchange. But if sex becomes just a service to be traded, that's not freedom. It's commerce. Ultimately, swinging is a traditional relationship with an escape hatch, a way to experience Helen Fisher's dual reproductive strategy without deception. If monogamy is like only being allowed to eat at home, as I told Joan, then swinging is like being allowed to eat wherever you want on the condition that your partner approves of the restaurant and eats with you. It's still a form of possession, only the chain is extended a few feet longer. In fact, if the way guys like Tommy talk about their girlfriends is any indication, partners are actually treated more like possessions than in monogamy. Perhaps it's time to create the world I want, rather than trying to fit into someone else's scene, to go in all the way on freedom, to finish building my free love dream house. With luck, I'll find the rest of the people I'm looking for in Paris. I'm running out of time. Belle is going to be here in just 5 weeks. Chapter 22. While driving back to Los Angeles, I try to reach Charles again. This time he answers the phone. "Are you okay?" I ask. "I've been worried about you." "I'm sorry," he answers in a quiet, halting voice. "I've been out of town. My whole world turned upside down, and I've been trying to make sense of it. What happened?" "I found out my wife's been cheating on me." He raises his voice. "For the past 12 years. I'm so shocked, I'm unable to form an articulate response. We were all so busy trying to earn back the trust of our partners in rehab, we never even considered questioning their integrity. The story Charles goes on to tell is fragmented, but as best I can piece it together, he was looking at his wife's phone when a text arrived from a security guard at her office building. It read, "I gave you my heart for 12 years. Just to make sure he was interpreting the message correctly, he texted back, "One thing's for sure, we definitely had great sex together." "Yes," came the reply, "I miss it." Digging for more, Charles texted, "Do you remember the first time we did it?" "In your car," came the reply. Charles kept paint chopping. "That's right, I sucked your cock." And the security guard responded, "You don't talk like that. Who is this?" At this point, Charles was shaking with an emotion beyond pain. He let the conversation drop and obsessively went through his wife's phone and emails. Soon he pieced the backstory together. Nearly every afternoon, his wife and the guard had been sneaking off for a lunchtime tryst for more than half their marriage. "Oh my God, how did you react?" I ask. "I've known people, mostly love addicts, who would be less hurt if their spouses died than if they cheated. They'd even prefer the former because at least they couldn't take it personally." But Charles's response is the last one I'd expect. The release was impossible to describe. "Because you were so angry?" "No, I was relieved." "You're kidding." "Neil, all my shame and guilt just melted off me." He pauses. "When she found out I'd relapsed, she threw me under the bus like she was so pristine and perfect. She told all her friends that I'd betrayed her again, and I was this terrible sex addict. She locked me out of the house and threatened to take everything I had and turn my own family against me. I felt so bad about myself for so long." His voice begins trembling. "But what she was doing, I just don't understand how she could be so cruel." I wonder how many other people go through years of sex addiction therapy and meetings trying to make amends, only to find out that their partner has also been cheating. Or even worse, they never find out and go to the grave thinking they're a sinner and their partner's a saint. One of the unfortunate axioms of human behavior is that what others shame people for the most is usually what they're doing in secret themselves. After all, an accusation is much more powerful than a denial. It's a way to seem one up when you're really feeling one down. "So are you going to stay in recovery?" I ask. There's a long silence on the other end of the line. "Well, I went away for a few days with my sponsor to cool down and determine the right thing to do." A deep inhale. "And I'm going to get divorced." A long exhale. "And then I'm going to start fucking something every day." This is not the Charles I've come to both pity and admire. It's a side of Charles I've never met. And so I get the chance to tell him a version of what he's been telling me for the last year. "That can't be what your sponsor recommended. It sounds more like your disease talking. Be careful." "Neil, I'm a 50-year-old man who's free of a 22-year-old marriage, half of which was a total lie. I just want to... I don't know. I don't know what's true anymore." A heaving sob explodes into the phone, followed by the muffled sound of crying. Some people live in an endless on-and-off relationship with control. Either they're trying to exert it over their lives by getting obsessive about a diet, a belief system, a phobia, a hobby, a need for order, a 12-step program, or they're completely out of control, making a mess of their lives. and it sounds like Charles is on the verge of a mess. The shadow he's been repressing has broken loose, and I can relate, so has mine. But as any good Jungian therapist will tell you, you're not supposed to repress the shadow in the first place. That's when bad things happen. The goal is to integrate it, and I hope that's the path we're both ultimately on. I want to ask Charles if he still thinks he's a sex addict, or if he thinks his wife is one, or if he thinks the disease was contagious and she caught it from him. But now is not the time to prove a point. Whatever you decide to do, I tell him instead, make sure you process it in group first. I will, Charles says, stifling his tears. So how are you feeling without Ingrid in your life? Do you miss her? It's the one question no one's asked. And in the moments of decadence, connection, and extreme awkwardness with the swingers, I've managed not to think about her. But in every other moment, I felt her presence somewhere, in my mind, my heart, my home, my conscience. Constantly, I tell him. Chapter 23. Everywhere I look while traveling to Paris, I see young couples pushing sleeping children in strollers, carrying blanket-wrapped babies in their arms, hurrying along superhero-backpacked toddlers. Each family makes me think of Ingrid and the future I ruined. I wonder what Ingrid's doing, who she's doing it with, and if she's happier living without my wandering eyes and ambivalent heart. One of the many hazards of breaking up is that it takes years not just to find love again, but to discover if it's real, stable, and sustainable. In Paris, however, everything will change. I will find the rest of my pod, and maybe, just like several little T-traumas add up to one big T-trauma, several little L-loves can add up to one big L-love. First, there is Anne. She's waiting in the hotel room when I arrive. She's slender and toned, with dirty blonde shoulder-length hair, minimal makeup, and boyish clothes. As I approach her, she looks deeply and mutely into me, with quivering brown eyes. I take a step toward her, brush her hair aside, and we kiss. We disrobe, get in bed, make love, spoon, and then she says, "Salut." It's the first word we've exchanged. Then there's James and Nicole's friend, Camille. "Hi, Neil," she texts. "I'm meeting my friend Laura, who's American just like you. She wants to go to a great switch club, and I promised I'd get in trouble with her. Do you want to come with us?" "Is it okay if I'm with a date?" I text back. "Dump the girl," she replies. "There'll be plenty of dates for you there, and they all want to have sex." This switch club sounds like a gold mine of open-minded single women. The only problem? I want to bring Anne. "If you have to bring her, use the 'we'll just have a drink and watch' technique," Camille relents. "That's how my boyfriend got me there in the first place, and look at me now." The club is by Montmartre. "Give me a call after dinner." In my relationship this last year, my credo was to say no. Only by saying no to others could I protect Ingrid's heart. But now, I am saying yes to everyone, to everything, to life, because every yes is the gateway to an adventure. Whatever I am heading toward, it is a relationship that operates out of a place of yes. At dinner that night, I do exactly as Camille instructed. Anne and I are with two women I met on a European press tour a few years earlier, a German fashion photographer and a Swedish designer. They spend most of the meal gossiping about people I don't know. "We don't have to do anything," I explain to Anne. "Let's just plan on having a drink and watching, and we can leave right away if it's lame." "I'm a little tired," she replies, her voice barely audible. Throughout the day, she's barely spoken. Instead, she's attached herself to me energetically, gazing at me almost constantly with big, vulnerable, barely blinking eyes. I get the sense that she wants something from me, or may already be getting it from me. "Is it okay if I go back to the hotel?" "Can we come?" the fashionistas interrupt. "You can go with them if you want," Anne tells me softly. It's hard to read Anne. I'm not sure if she's legitimately tired or just uncomfortable with the suggestion. Are you sure it's all right for me to go? I don't mind, she replies. I study her face to make sure she's sincere, that it's not a test to see if I'll choose her. She appears placid and unconcerned. I ask her three more times, just to make sure. She said you could go, the German photographer snaps at me. Yes, it turns out, is not an easy principle to live by. I wonder why, after knowing Anne for just a day, I already feel like it's wrong to do this without her. Perhaps the problem is not that the people I date want to possess me. It's that after sex, I give them ownership out of guilt. I'm replaying an enmeshment script, pathologically accommodating to monogamy. If I truly believed that sexual possession was wrong and acted accordingly, I wouldn't have agreed to an exclusive relationship with Ingrid in the first place and would have saved us both a lot of grief. In life, whoever has the strongest reality wins. Lose your moral certainty and lose the ground you stand on. We drop Anne off at the hotel, and she gives me a deep kiss and walks off. It's a good sign. Letting your lover go to a sex club alone is actually a much more open-minded feat than going with him. As the taxi speeds away, the German photographer loops her arm in mine. I'm determined not to wreck this orgy like all the others. My stomach is full, so I won't be snacking on popcorn, and I haven't touched a single mood-altering substance, nor do I plan to. I even clipped my nails. We arrive at the club just after midnight. I spot Camille instantly. She has long brown hair, worthy of a shampoo commercial, and skin so smooth and flawless that a metaphor to an inanimate object like a pearl would hardly do it justice. She's standing with two other women. Laura, her American friend, who looks like a burning candle, long and narrow, with a white pantsuit and a shock of short blonde hair. And Veronica, a haughty beauty from Prague, with lips like cylindrical sofa cushions, flowing brown hair, an overdeveloped nose, and a tall, thin, sensuous frame that reminds me of the actress Jane Birkin. Do we have to put on robes or towels when we go in? I ask Camille, unsure what protocol is for places like this. Camille looks at me like I'm crazy. No, we just wear our clothes. That's a relief. Despite my desire to be open, evolved, and shame-free about sex, I'm still not totally comfortable with the sight of my own body. The first time I ever had sex, I was too embarrassed to remove my shirt, and the second and third times as well. Behind us in line, there's a Frenchman with a shiny suit and slicked back hair. He looks like a shady businessman who snorts a lot of cocaine. Since you have so many girls, is it okay if I come in with you? He asks. The club has a rule that all males must enter with a female, and I'm standing there with five of them like a glutton. I suppose this is what I missed when I was dating Ingrid. Options, variety, adventure, discovery, novelty, the unknown. As Lorraine would put it, intensity. I don't know, I tell him. It's my first time here. As we wait, Camille and Laura discuss sharing toys, by which they mean boys. Is your boyfriend coming? I ask Camille. No. Does he know you're here? I'm asking not to judge her, but because I'm curious how their relationship works. No. She smiles guiltily. Clearly having an open relationship is no cure for infidelity. First Nicole, then Sage's story about her ex-boyfriend, now Camille. Perhaps the problem with most relationships is that the rules start to become more important than the values they're supposed to be representing. Eventually, two of Camille's toys arrive, both in designer jackets and skinny ties. They introduce themselves as Bruno and Pascal. Bruno looks like a clean-cut college athlete, while Pascal, with thin-framed glasses, tight curls, and slow, well-mannered gestures, looks like an intellectual dandy. Unlike the highly sexualized crowd at Bliss, the men and women here aren't divorced weekend warriors dressed like porn stars. Aside from the slick-haired businessman behind us, they're all young, hip, well-dressed, and silicone-free. They don't look much different than the crowd outside an exclusive nightclub. Evidently, after a night on the town, they come here for dessert. As the line starts moving, Laura takes pity on Solo Slick Guy and invites him to come in with her. "Do you know how I can tell these people are barbarians?" the German photographer says to her friend. "Look at their shoes. I wouldn't wish a single pair on my worst enemy. It seems I make a critical mistake at every orgy, and the fashionistas may be this orgy's ruiners. But it's too late to slip away from them. We're being let inside." When we enter, a hostess asks us to check our jackets, which for some reason leads to sniggers from the fashionistas, then gives me a card that she explains will serve as my tab for the night. Veronica removes her blazer to reveal a loose-fitting backless dress that, when her stride is long, would get her arrested. "She will be my first fuck tonight," Pascal tells me confidently as I stare mutely at the tan expanse of Veronica's back. We walk downstairs to an empty, low-lit dance floor dotted with stripper poles. The 20 or so people in the room are clustered against a bar, drinking away their inhibitions. Katy Perry's "I Kissed a Girl" is playing. It seems so obvious. At the end of the anteroom, there's a black door that leads to the fun. After her friends have drifted into the rooms behind it, Camille takes my hand and offers to show me around. "What about my friends?" I ask. "They'll be fine. Are you coming or not?" I look over, and they seem deep in snide conversation, concealing their discomfort by increasing their arrogance. I should invite them to join us, especially since I brought them here. The last thing I want to do, however, is walk around the orgy with them making obnoxiously loud comments about how everyone's sexual techniques are so last year. I feel guilty leaving them behind, just as I left Anne behind, but I say yes. Chapter 24. Behind the black door, Camille and I slowly wander through sunken living rooms and small porthole-fitted chambers, all in copious use, until we arrive at a space that consists of just an enormous bed and a narrow walkway along the front wall. Most of the women on the mega bed are completely naked, while the men are still wearing dress shirts, ties, and pants. However, their pants are all unzipped or lowered, and their junk is hanging out. Dicks are everywhere. Even the guys who aren't with women are walking around the room with expectant cocks dangling in the air in case someone has a need for them. I'm the only guy who's zipped up. Until Bliss, I'd rarely seen a guy naked before. And here, with more people in less space, it looks like a snake pit. In the bottom right corner of the bed, Laura is on all fours with her dress up. Bruno pulls out of her and parks in Camille's mouth, while Pascal, true to his word, fucks Veronica against the wall. She's standing up, facing frontward with one leg raised and her face flushed, in a pose that, if photographed, would incite a million sticky nights. I don't know what to do, how to get involved, or what the rules are. At least James and Nicole explained what was happening at Bliss and made sure to include me. But here, it's much more extreme, the closest to a free-for-all I've ever seen. I sit in the empty space on the mattress in front of Laura, who's still posed on her hands and knees expectantly. "Thanks for letting me come here with you guys," I tell her, because I feel like I need to say something. "Is this your first time at a switch club?" she asks astutely. This is probably the stupidest place I've tried to make small talk since the last orgy. Pretty much. As we're talking, the creepy businessman from outside the club materializes behind Laura and rubs her pussy. Then he scoots under her like he's repairing a car and starts eating her out. "Is that cool with you?" I ask her. "I can tell him to stop if you're not comfortable." Here I go again, taking care of everyone's needs but my own. "That's so American of you to say," she laughs. "What do you mean? How is that American? I don't even understand the comment. She's American herself." "No one's ever asked me that before," she says. "But I thought maybe. I just want a cock in me." This is the kind of woman I fantasized about as a teenager. An indiscriminate one. And more than even the Pujas and Bliss, this seems like free sex, because there's no spiritual baggage, drug baggage, or even much relationship baggage around it. In fact, there's no baggage or encumbrances whatsoever, just randomly intersecting body parts. And now that I'm in the midst of it, I'm terrified. It's so shockingly open. It's not society that holds us back. It's ourselves. We just blame society, because not only is it easier, but it's a nearly impossible weight to move. This way, we don't actually have to change. I thought I was fighting the system, but all I've really been doing is fighting myself. First my compulsions, now my inhibitions. Meanwhile, the slick-haired guy stops licking Laura and appears to be going for a home run. "Can you make sure he puts on a condom?" she asks. "Okay," I reply overenthusiastically, grateful for the opportunity. I have a job to do now, a purpose. I am the condom police. I watch him carefully to make sure he puts the rubber on. Then I worry that I'm creeping him out, but I won't be swayed from my very important duty. No protection, no service. "That's right, sir. Roll it on all the way. Otherwise, I'm going to have to ask you to step out of the bed." "It's on," I tell her with an air of authority. As he thrusts inside her, Laura's face swings closer to mine. Now's my chance, I think, and I start making out with her. And that's when I realize, no one else here is making out. How many dicks has she had in that mouth tonight? So I pull away. It's time to say yes and unzip. I kneel so that my crotch is level with her head, and sure enough, the power of the cock right there in front of the face is too strong to deny. She takes it in her hands, guides it into her mouth, and starts sucking. I realize this is very crude, but the story takes place in a sex club. What else am I supposed to describe? Chandeliers? There's nothing going on here but sex. "What do you like?" Laura pauses to ask. "Good question. I like this. What's better than a blowjob?" Or does she want more specific instructions? Perhaps they have names for different blowjobs here. The spit shine, the round the world, the confused American. Like anything, I suppose sexual freedom is a learned art. I still need more experience to get comfortable. Suddenly, I see Pascal's head appear over mine. He whispers in my ear, "Veronica wants you." It's music to my ears, especially since things with Laura feel awkward. I know she has an any-cock-will-do attitude, but I have a sneaking suspicion that my cock isn't quite doing. When the businessman finishes, Laura makes her escape. But instead of Veronica appearing, Camille kneels in front of me and takes Laura's place with more enthusiasm. I'm not fully present because I've been stuck in my upper head, so I look around the room and notice an exotic-looking woman lying in front of me. I take her hand and start massaging it, and she massages my hand back. I move my hand between her thighs and start playing with her. She's soaking wet. Good thing I clip my nails. I'm starting to get comfortable here. Finally, I'm actually part of an orgy. Awake, accepted, alive. I rear up tall and look around. Everyone is fucking and sucking. Perhaps my previous disasters in the swing and poly scenes have actually been necessary experiences to get comfortable at these things, learning lessons on the road to orgy mastery. Suddenly, I hear a guy's voice exclaim loudly, "Tu es sur ma jambe." Nearly everyone in the mega bed starts laughing. Evidently, I'm kneeling on some guy's leg. I slide out of his way and notice Veronica crawling toward me on the mattress. I drink in her unique amalgamation of devastating beauty and awkward innocence, and I instantly harden. I make out with her passionately. I don't know why I keep touching people's filthy lips, but I crave the intimacy and connection more than the anonymous sex. Maybe I am polyamorous, because it's not just free sex I'm searching for. It's free romance, free connection, free relationships, free getting naked with someone you enjoy and who enjoys you, and then getting to know each other even better afterward. I seriously need to gargle with Listerine when I leave this place. Meanwhile, Bruno has appeared out of nowhere and started having sex with the exotic-looking woman. I pull back and look at Veronica's face, and she bites her lower lip in response. There is so much heat between us, and we've only just met. I hope it isn't because she was abandoned by her father. I run a finger across her lips, and she sucks it into her mouth. And, oh God, I feel like I'm about to. But I don't want this to end, so I pull out of Camille's mouth. Let me suck you, she begs. This is the best night of my life. The scene on this bed is basically what Muslim martyrs are promised in the afterlife, except with virgins. But paradise is here, now. I've finally entered the world I've been reading about in porn magazines and watching in adult movies since puberty. Just as women are trained by media and society to look for their prince charming, men are conditioned to look for their nasty slut. Not for a marriage, but just for an adventure. Both are fairy tales, but a prince charming is nearly impossible to find because it's a lifetime illusion to sustain. It takes only a few minutes to play the role of nasty slut. The only thing keeping me from fully enjoying this sexual paradise is the guilt. That Anne is in the hotel worrying, that the fashionistas are angry, and that because I'm liking this so much, it means I'm a sex addict, as is everyone else here. The counselors at rehab have really done a number on my head. I used to be worried just about sexually transmitted diseases, but they've turned sex itself into a disease. And now, anytime I'm giving myself over to pleasure, I hear Joan's voice in the back of my head telling me I'm avoiding intimacy. Just as I promised Rick I'd go all in on addiction treatment without doubt, I need to go all in on freedom without guilt. The answer will become clear over time. Either I'll hit bottom, as Charles predicted, or I'll find a solution that works for my life, as I hope. I need to get out of my head and be present for this experience, and to remember why I'm here, not to have a lot of sex, but to find my relationship orientation and like-minded partners. As my eyes meet Veronica's again, I notice a dick hanging in my peripheral vision, like a cloud covering the sun. Its owner says to me in a thick French accent, "Oh, the girls here, they have been sucking your dick." I guess so. Do you like having your dick sucked? It seems like an obvious question, but I reply anyway. Yes? I try not to make eye contact. This conversation definitely isn't helping my staying power. Would you like that I should suck your dick? No thanks. I don't know why, but the situation seems to call for politeness. I'm good. I suppose if I technically wanted total freedom, I'd let him go to town. But, I realize, the goal isn't sexual anarchy. It's that I want the rules around my sexuality to be self-imposed, not externally imposed. That's the key difference, perhaps in everything. The goal, then, is liberation, to be the master of my orgasm. I don't want my partner to own it, which would be monogamy, but I also don't want the orgasm to own me, which would be addiction. My new admirer has inadvertently given me a gift. Though he doesn't say anything else, I keep seeing his dick, on my right side, then my left, then a foot above me, as if he's hoping that by just dangling it around me, at some point I'll decide to show my appreciation. That seems to be how things work here. Maybe this is where all the women hang out who actually like it when guys text photos of their dicks. A Valkyrie with long blonde hair and missile breasts clambers into the bed with her boyfriend. I eye-fuck her to get back into the spirit of the orgy. She holds my gaze. But before I get a chance to do a thing about it, Bruno appears out of the blue and starts fucking her. I don't know how he does it. This must be his 10th woman. Suddenly, I remember that Camille has been down there sucking me for half an hour straight. I put on a condom, lie down, and move her on top of me. Camille rides me as Veronica positions herself over my face. I am smothered in woman. If this is happening right now because my mother smothered me, then I owe her a serious thank you. Suddenly, a loud, condescending German voice fills the room. Where is he? I tilt my head back and see an upside-down image of the fashionistas, standing against the wall, staring into the massive bodies. It's just like him to do this to us. I try to shield myself underneath the women so the fashionistas don't spot me. Let's just leave without him. Their voices cut through the room, killing all sexuality in their path. So selfish. For a millisecond, I consider stopping. I should probably get back to the hotel and check on Anne anyway. Then I think, no, this is amazing. I don't want to stop this. So I'm selfish. Let me be selfish. They can leave and I'll deal with it later. I'm learning how to take care of my own needs for a change. In moments like these, the true nature of one's soul is revealed. Let's switch, Veronica suggests. This is a switch club after all, so I slide out of Camille so she can swap places with Veronica. However, as soon as Camille's lower orifice is free, Bruno is in there. The guy never misses an opportunity. I'm sure he's a great businessman in the outside world. Veronica slides her body over mine, her skin rubbing against my clothing, her back arched so we can see each other's faces. I switch condoms and slowly enter her. We move against each other sensuously. Time slows. We fall out of sync with the rest of the club and into each other. I gaze deeply into the world in Veronica's eyes, and she into mine. And it feels like love. Not the love that is a thought that comes with expectations of commitment and fears of abandonment, but the love that is an emotion that makes no demands and knows no fear. I found, for a moment, love in a swing club. Connected sex is a spiritual experience, but not in the way that Tantra polys describe it. It is spiritual because it's a release from ego, a merging with the other, a discorporation into the atoms vibrating around us, a connection to the universal energy that moves through all things without judgment or prejudice. Thus, orgasm is the one spiritual practice that unites nearly everyone on the planet. Perhaps that is why there's so much fear and baggage around it. Because they were right, both in rehab and at the puja, it is sacred. And every orgasm is in itself an act of faith, an attempt to reach out, and just for a moment, relieve our separateness, escape from time, and touch eternity. And yes, as she drenches the mattress, I filled the condom. Not only did I find love in an orgy, I think I found enlightenment. Chapter 25. Should we go get a drink? I ask Veronica as we slide off the bed. What we really should go get is a shower. I need a cigarette, Camille says, crawling away from Bruno, who quickly slips away, no doubt looking for another business opportunity. Back in the lounge, I no longer feel guilt. Not about the experience, which was incredible. Not about Anne, who was responsible for her own decisions. Not about the fashionistas, who chose to remain separate from everyone and are probably back at their hotel talking shit about how the birthmark on my left ass cheek looks like a fake Gucci symbol or something. We walk upstairs to a smoking room, and Veronica and I finally have a chance to talk. It's like the perfect date in reverse. First have sex, then get to know each other. She's a lapsed visual arts graduate student with a fiercely independent streak, a passion for learning new things, and a light melancholy worn under her skin for insulation. She speaks in a thick Czech accent, clipped and blunt. There's a coldness in it that probably comes from generations of ancestors who froze and starved and suffered and survived against all odds so that she could be here today fucking a bunch of strangers in a trendy Paris club. It was my first time, she tells me. I liked it. You mean you haven't been here before? No, I'm visiting a guy in Paris. I told him I was only coming as a friend, but when I wouldn't have sex with him, he got angry. Camille lives next door, so she said she would take me out tonight without him. You don't want to sleep with him, but you had sex with all these random guys? This is for the experience. That guy is too pushy. He threatened to kick me out when I wouldn't kiss him today. If you want, I offer, you can stay with me. I'm here for a few more days. I would like that, she says, unsmiling yet smiling. As we continue speaking, I'm reminded of a line from a classic 60s song. I could be in love with almost everyone, I think that people are the greatest fun. And this is what I'm discovering since leaving Ingrid. Whether it's Nicole or Sage, Anne or Veronica, each woman is a wonderful world unto herself. And monogamy? It's like choosing to live in a single town and never traveling to experience the beauty, history, and enchantment of all the other unique, wonderful places in the world. Why does love have to limit us? Perhaps it doesn't. Only fear is restrictive. Love is expansive. And I wonder, since fear of enmeshment impels us to avoid commitment, and fear of abandonment makes us possessive, what type of evolved relationship can emerge once those wounds are healed? For the first time, Ingrid is starting to recede in my mind, to become a beautiful memory, a heartrending casualty from my misguided attempt at monogamy. In front of me, a world of endless relational and sexual possibilities is opening up. Behind me, a struggle is ending. Even if someone is your perfect match, it's unlikely to work if your core values are different. When Veronica mentions a documentary she recently saw called The Workshop, about a retreat in which participants get naked and have group sex to heal their shame and find enlightenment, I decide to tell her about the poly house I'm putting together. "That sounds fun," she replies, and rests her head on my shoulder. "I'd be interested in trying that with you, depending on when you do it." My heart races. If things work out after spending more time together, I just may have a V. The rest of Camille's friends soon surface, and we part ways outside the club, all exchanging numbers. When I return to the hotel, Anne embraces me, not with fear or relief or jealousy or worry, but with acceptance. She nuzzles happily into my shoulder and whispers, "I want to be an experienced woman." And that's when I realize I've done it. I'm living in a world of liberated women and free sexuality. It's becoming my lifestyle, my reality. I am finding my tribe. Now it's time not just to have sex with multiple partners, but to build intimate relationships with them also. Time to find out if this way of life is truly sustainable for me and can lead to a better kind of love, a stronger kind of family, and a fuller sense of happiness.
Stage 3. Harem Life. The Prophet Muhammad used to visit all his wives in a round, during the day and night, and they were 11 in number. I asked Anas, "Had the Prophet the strength for it?" Anas replied, "We used to say that the Prophet was given the strength of 30 men." Abu Qatada, Sahih al-Bukhari, Volume 1, Book 5, Number 268.
Chapter 26. Deep in our nature, we are foragers, and life is a process of gathering the resources we need from a large, connected planet. It's all out there. Every color, shade, flavor, and mutation of life and experience. Whatever we are looking for, we will find, if it doesn't find us first. However, the result will not be what we're consciously looking for, but what we're unconsciously seeking. And so, what we want will never be anything like what we expect. It is the forager's law. You can find the berry bush, but you can't control its yield. I leave Paris with plans to live with three lovers. Anne, who is overjoyed at the prospect of being together again so soon. Veronica, with whom I spent 3 blissful days in Paris after Anne left. And Belle, who has stayed in constant contact this whole time. I had met each of them under adventurous circumstances that went well, so it didn't take much for them to agree to continue the adventure. I wonder what Shama Helena would call this relationship. It's one too many people for a V. I guess it would be a quad, or a one-legged W, maybe a tridactyl foot. Whatever the case, I'm excited to finally turn the corner from observing non-monogamous relationships to being in them. Since I'm walking into the unknown, I do my best to prepare. I speak with the three women almost daily after returning to Los Angeles, getting to know them better. And with each text and call, the connection grows and blossoms. It has the feeling of a new romance, filled with hope and expectation, unsullied by reality. It's clearly premature to move in together, which is why we've agreed to try it out for 2 weeks initially to see how it goes. It's a shame I ruined things with Sage, because she's the only woman I've been with so far who has experience in a group relationship like this. Because the guest house I rent is too small for four people, I call the owner of the big, dilapidated treehouse I looked at with Rick when I was dating Ingrid. Unfortunately, it's not available, so I scout for other options, sending the girls photos of my favorite places. "Why don't you just do it here in San Francisco?" Nicole suggests when I fill her in on my plans. There is no place in the world more tolerant of alternative relationships. All those books on polyamory you've been reading, most of those authors live here, and I can get you into all the underground parties. Nicole has been my Beatrice in this new paradigm, and she hasn't let me down yet. I think she enjoys taking on the role of alt-relationship tour guide to fresh recruits. So I agree to try this new relationship somewhere new. A few days before Belle, Anne, and Veronica are scheduled to arrive, I find a decently priced vacation rental near Fisherman's Wharf. It's a two-story apartment with three bedrooms, which will allow each of my sort of girlfriends to have her own room, closet, and bathroom. Ideally, the women will build corresponding relationships with one another and will all end up sleeping in the same bedroom. But in a worst-case scenario, I can just spend the night with each separately in a regular rotation, which is presumably how most polygamists do it. Veronica is scheduled to arrive first. Belle's plane lands 7 hours later, and the following afternoon, Anne gets into town. So it's with equal parts astonishment and anxiety that I wait for Veronica at the airport, preparing to turn what seemed like an impossible relationship fantasy into a daily reality. Eventually, I see her emerge from customs. She's 2 inches taller than me, and probably 30 pounds lighter, wearing high heels, skinny jeans, a tight yellow t-shirt, and the soulful sadness that never leaves her eyes. Her accent cuts strong and seductive through the crowd, with trilling R's that make me think of a Cold War spy. 3 hours later, we're lying in bed, content in the afternoon light of San Francisco, having a post-coital talk about body language. I try to take a snapshot of the moment in my heart so I can remember the exhilarating feeling of having gone from strangers to lovers to domestic partners in a matter of weeks. If I'd stayed with Ingrid, I never would have gotten to experience this. My phone beeps with a text from Anne, who says she's packing and looking forward to holding me. I text her back and let her know that the girls and I are looking forward to holding her, too. Just a reminder that, as Orpheus put it, this is about family. A few minutes later, Belle texts to let me know she landed on an earlier flight and has vajazzled herself for me. I have no idea what that means, but I tell her it sounds hot and will come pick her up immediately. When Belle responds that it'll be easier for her to take a cab to the apartment, Veronica sighs, exasperated. She gets out of bed, wraps a towel around her body, opens her suitcase, and starts hanging clothes in the closet. There is a light violence in the sound of each hanger hitting the brass bar. "What's wrong?" I ask. "Nothing." "Nothing always means something," I reply. "I'm open to talking about it." "I'm fine, really." She unpacks her toiletries and brings them into the bathroom. A gentle frost accompanies the breeze of her every movement. "Fine," I tell her, stands for fucked up, insecure, neurotic, and emotional. She is unamused. "It's disrespectful to keep texting girls when you're with me," she snaps. And I think she's right. Then I think I'm fucked. There's only one woman in the house right now, and we're already having jealousy issues. The exhilarating feeling of domesticity disappears instantly. But this is what I'm here for, to be in reality about this lifestyle. It's easy to have sex with other people's wives and girlfriends, but learning to actually be relational, as Joan would put it, with multiple partners is far more challenging because it's not just body parts intersecting, it's feelings. Anything goes in a switch club between two strangers, but here in the real world as two lovers, everything now means something. So I need to choose my next words carefully and with maturity if I want the experience to go well. Because it's not just about a couple of weeks. It's about my future. I was texting to make arrangements with the girls who are coming to stay with us, I tell her. But from now on, unless we're making plans for that day, let's all try to ignore the phone when we're together so we can be in the moment with each other. She nods and smiles, content with the diplomacy. I used to think that a good relationship meant always getting along. But the secret, I realize, is that when one person shuts down or throws a fit, the other needs to stay in the adult ego state. If both people descend to the wounded child or adapted adolescent, that's when all the forces of relationship drama and destruction are unleashed. I share this with Veronica and teach her about the different ego states. Soon, we're connected again. I'm already learning things from being here, and that's why I came, she says happily. An hour later, Belle arrives. She's pale and petite, wearing a plaid skirt, a navy blue cardigan, a white blouse, funky red glasses, and braided honey blonde pigtails. It's a schoolgirl look designed to drive men wild with both lust and guilt simultaneously. Is this your den of sin, Mr. Strauss? She asks playfully as we embrace in the doorway. I lead her to the living room to meet Veronica. Then I leave them alone for a few minutes and give them a chance to get acquainted without me. After a while, I hear laughter, a good sign. I return and Veronica tells me she's going to take a walk. As soon as she leaves, Belle jumps in my lap and starts removing my clothes. I assume they worked out an arrangement between themselves. Already, the impossible is happening here. Women like Chelsea put an extraordinary amount of effort into trying to look like the doctored photos they see in magazines. But more exciting and more forbidden than that impossible feminine ideal is the nakedness of tender flesh that should not be uncovered. Skin so pale and thin that it seems like exposure to light and air will damage it. Flesh that seems to tremble all on its own simply from being looked at. This is Belle's body. It is marred only when I discover what she means by vajazzle. It's a bedazzled vagina, with brightly colored sequins stuck where pubic hair used to be. It's as pointless as it sounds. Minutes after we get our clothes back on, Veronica returns. I watch her face and movements carefully. She doesn't seem upset. We get ready for dinner, then walk downstairs to my Durango, balancing on a thread of unity. That thread threatens to snap as soon as we get to the car, where I encounter the first challenge of a group relationship. Both women stand in front of the passenger door, bristling with anxiety, waiting for me to make a decision. Since we didn't pick Belle up at the airport, she should sit in front, I tell Veronica. Then you can have the front seat on the way home. It's embarrassing to hear these words come out of my mouth. It sounds like something my father might have said to my brother and me when I was 12. I don't remember anyone teaching multiple partner seating arrangements at the World Polyamory Association conference. I get the sudden feeling that nothing about this experience is going to be like I expected. I am living under the Forager's Law. Chapter 27. Belle sits at dinner in her schoolgirl outfit, gawked at by every pervert in the restaurant. Oh my God, she's saying, throwing back her third drink of the night. I went on a total lingerie shopping spree before I came here. I want to model it all for you tonight. Normally, this would be ideal dinner conversation. However, there's a problem. She's only looking at me when she speaks. In fact, she's acting as if Veronica isn't even at the table. I can sense the frost beginning to coat Veronica's skin. When Veronica goes to the bathroom, I remind Belle, make sure you include Veronica when you talk. I don't care about her, she responds. I only care about you. Her words floor me. But that's not why we're in San Francisco. We discussed exploring polyamory here. And that means more than just the two of us are involved. I know. She sighs and stares at her drink, like a child disciplined for doing something she knew was wrong in the first place. Bringing lovers together can evidently be like introducing cats. Everything must be done with care, thought, and precision. Otherwise, they'll never get along. After dinner, I take them to a speakeasy in the Tenderloin called Wilson and Wilson, hoping a change of scenery will foster more camaraderie. But with every cocktail, Belle gets more talkative and Veronica gets more irritated until she's looking at the table when Belle talks. And avoiding eye contact with people is worse than directly telling them they annoy you. It's your soul telling their soul that it annoys you. This is already teetering on the brink of disaster, and Anne hasn't even arrived yet. Father Yod seemed to live in harmony with 14 different wives at his peak, so surely I can make things work with just two. I flash back to rehab. The guys in my group were all very different, but what enabled us to form deep connections quickly was discussing our timelines and childhoods. Maybe it's time to end the small talk and really get to know one another. I'm curious, I say to Belle, changing the subject. What were your parents like when you were growing up? They were perfect. They loved me very much. She takes a sip of her cocktail, then looks up at us, a big red smile covering the truth like a latex mask. Whenever people idealize their caretakers, chances are pretty good that the opposite is true. Sometimes this illusion is created by the parents, who insist in godlike fashion that they're perfect and that the child owes them obedience because they're responsible for his or her existence. Other times, the illusion is created by the child as a survival strategy, disconnecting from reality in order to avoid the pain of growing up in a toxic environment. So I make an ill-advised attempt to break through Belle's walls. I explain this theory to her, concluding, no parent is capable of being perfect. They're only capable of telling their children they are. And you can get good things from bad parents, Veronica adds, allowing herself to engage with Belle. She wants to help. We're growing closer already. My father was never around when I was growing up, Veronica continues, and my mother always worked. So I was taking the bus alone around the city when I was only 8. That's why I'm so independent now. I wonder if I give off an enmeshment pheromone that attracts abandoned women, or if it's just that the majority of fathers are so shitty that most women have been abandoned by them in some way. As we continue with our stories, Belle slams her drink onto the table and shouts so loudly that heads turn. All right, my mom is a narcissistic, self-righteous bitch. Then her face scrunches and tears pour out. Don't go there anymore, okay? Just don't go there. You kept pushing, and now you're there. And just like that, our moment of intimate connection has popped. Or has it? At least Belle broke through to reality. Now we know who she is. Just as some people have a drug or sex addiction, she has a word addiction. She builds a wall of words to protect herself from uncomfortable feelings. However, when someone is enmeshed with a parent of the same sex, this can make it difficult for them to form intimate friendships of the same gender. So that may be a big barrier for us as a quad. On a more encouraging note, now that we've shared our vulnerabilities, Veronica's actually started looking into Belle's eyes again when she speaks. Lesson of the day. The quickest route to polyharmony and life among the rest of the walking wounded is truth and understanding. As we leave, Veronica puts her arms around me and kisses the back of my neck. Then she moves my arm around Belle, and we all walk out together. I kiss each of them on the lips, and for the first time that day, I have hope. We feel like a V. When we return home, Veronica says she wants to take a shower. I step into one of the bathrooms to clean up and prepare myself for the culmination of our first night together. But as I'm standing there, Belle walks in behind me, flicks my ear provocatively with her tongue, and whispers, "I want to fuck you, but I want you to turn around first and put your cock deep down my throat." "I'd like to do that so badly," I tell her, "but we need to wait until Veronica's out of the shower." I lead her into Veronica's room, and we lie on the bed and talk while waiting. But after a couple of minutes, Belle starts to fidget. Then she suddenly jumps up and runs through the house, laughing and giggling. And my hope, once again, plummets. Belle seems to have gone haywire. I'm not sure if it's the alcohol, the jet lag, the nervousness, the mother wound we poked, petulance about having to wait for Veronica, or some kind of misguided flirtation meant to get me chasing her. Veronica emerges from the bathroom and lies down next to me, the sound of Belle crashing into walls, laughing hysterically, and panting like she has asthma, fills the house. "What's that girl doing now?" Veronica asks, her voice dripping with condescension. "I honestly have no idea," I tell her. When I met Belle, she was shy, cerebral, and good-humored. This is a side of her I've never seen. In fact, I've been around more drunk women than I'd care to admit, and this is something I've never experienced or even imagined before. All I'm able to empathize with right now are the walls. Life has a sick sense of humor. One of the reasons I felt so trapped with Ingrid was that I resented her from holding me back from sleeping with Belle. But now, all I want is a break from her, and it hasn't even been 12 hours. Perhaps the secret to fidelity is knowing that the grass is crazier on the other side. Belle runs back into the room, jumps into bed, and tries to kiss Veronica, but Veronica turns her head away wordlessly. Belle freezes for a moment, then stands up and stumbles back out of the room. We hear her running manically through the house again, opening and closing closet doors, until finally she runs into her bathroom, shuts the door, and locks it. "Maybe she's on a medication that reacts badly with alcohol," I apologize to Veronica. "Maybe she is," she responds dispassionately, then rolls over and grabs her journal and a pen from the bedside table. I wonder what she's writing. I should probably ask everyone to keep a journal of her experience here so we can untangle it later. I lie silently next to her, hoping that tonight is an aberration, that Belle just got too nervous and drank too much, that through some miracle, Veronica will forgive and forget. "This isn't supposed to be our honeymoon night," I remind myself, "but simply the first date." When I wake in the morning, Belle is back in bed, and the three of us are spooning. That's when I discover yet another challenge of polyamory. It's difficult to get up and go to the bathroom without disturbing anyone when you're sandwiched between two sleeping women. But at least there's still hope for this group relationship. After all, things can't get any weirder than they did last night. Chapter 28. Excerpts from Veronica's journal.
"I just arrived to the airport, and I'm waiting to go through customs. I'm so happy he asked me to come here. Last time we saw each other, I loved him. At least for a few hours until my mind took over. I guess he has many girls like me, just like I have my other potentials. For me, it's not a problem. Let it be. Since the day I was born, my life has been adventurous. I'm not sure how it was possible that so many things happened to me all the time. I guess I was silly and careless and extreme, and also there wasn't anyone to look after me. My father was most of the time drunk, or at work, or both, and my mom was always busy looking after the garden and the animals, and she had some kind of job somewhere also. What I've learned about relationships is that the most important thing is talking. If two or more people have a relationship, they must be able to talk with each other with no hesitation about their feelings. As an example, I was upset about his texting and didn't say anything, but he understood me and started to talk with me himself. I told him what I was feeling and ever since that moment, everything's been different. We changed our behavior and found a compromise. It was very surprising because it wasn't hard at all. I'm so glad that he did it. Stretched out cardigan, white shirt, plaid skirt, black high platform shoes, glasses, Pippi Longstocking pigtails, Aussie, total schoolgirl outfit, very porn, cheap, but still interesting, and I guess men definitely love it. But he chose a girl like that to be part of this? Terrible. I think I must have been okay with this idea only because I wanted to spend more time with him. I think I wasn't quite able to imagine how things were going to be here. I was silly, but I'm learning from it, and that's good. I'm already sick of that girl. She talks so much. It feels like she's not going to stop ever. And I don't look at him with the "I'm in love" look anymore. I feel like he's not able to feel sincere feelings. I feel like everything is mind games so he could make his idea come true. If he really cared about me, he wouldn't do this to me. Is he planning to fuck us all just one after another? What is he thinking? He feels like he can do everything. And at the same time, we gave him permission for it. The difference between men and women is that we do things that we sometimes don't want to for something better. We gave him permission because of love. We hoped one day he would be ours. But maybe we actually just gave him away. Now the Australian girl has become so desperate that she acts like a crazy person. She laughs all the time very loudly, but I guess deep inside she's crying. There's no logic in her behavior. She's really drunk and looking for him in closets. Seems like the situation makes us all act a little funny. Tomorrow, the third girl is coming. She's French. I hope she's going to be more normal, not like this one here.
Chapter 29. In the morning, Veronica makes eggs in the hole for the three of us, and we sit around the breakfast table talking. Now that Bella's sober, there's actually a semblance of comfortable domesticity. I'm not sure if Veronica will ever respect Belle after last night, but at least she's tolerating her. Hopefully Anne, with her quiet, centered energy, will be the connective tissue we're missing. When we drive to the airport, Veronica gets the front seat since she made breakfast. I know, it's absurd. As we arrive, I spot Anne standing expectantly outside the terminal, the missing toe of our tridactyl foot, looking so fragile that she'd blow over if a truck drove by too quickly. Her eyes, glowing like headlights, seem to take up a quarter of her face, the rest of which is obscured by strands of unkempt blonde hair. When I jump out to greet her, she embraces me for a quiet, connecting minute. Then she climbs into the back seat, and I take them on a mini tour of the city. "She's incredible," Veronica tells me when we return home. "I think there's a lot I can learn from her." I breathe a sigh of relief. Maybe this is the dose of fresh air and a peaceful energy we needed for balance. Perhaps this quad will actually work now. That night, we join James and Nicole at supper club, followed by an after party at Nicole's loft with six other swinger and BDSM couples, including the inescapable Chelsea and Tommy. Her loft is the swinger version of a bachelor pad. There are scaffolding towers hung with lights and speakers, all remote controlled from her computer. A stripper pole in the center of the room, even an inexplicable round table like the one in Corey Feldman's hotel suite. Veronica and Anne sit on the couch and discuss the healing center in France where Anne does acupuncture for a living. I put an arm around them and join the conversation. Belle, who snuck a couple of drinks in, sits on my other side and takes my free hand. For a moment,